Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
978 days, 12 hours, 54 minutes, 29 seconds, 27 seconds, 25 seconds, until George W. Bush leaves office voluntarily. That's assuming that there's not an impeachment between now and then. Welcome to our program here on this Wednesday, the 17th of May. There you go. Welcome back to our program. And a lot to talk about today. The next 6 months in Iraq are critical, says Tom Friedman, again and again and again. Speaking of that region, the Herald in the UK has confirmed just in the last few hours that the Pentagon has confirmed to them that the U.S. is updating contingency plans for strikes against Iran, as the president of Iran has said thanks but no thanks to a European offer for a light water reactor. Tens of thousands are evacuated out of China as the biggest typhoon in the history of the world, apparently, in written history. The biggest May typhoon is about to hit that country. This is a country that has, you know, a written history that goes back thousands of years, and a lot of people suggesting, actually in China, suggesting this has to do with global warming. So that and a whole lot of other things, H5N1 flu, we may have the first case of human-to-human transmission coming out of the Far East. We'll update you on all of those things and much, much more as we go throughout the 3 hours of our program today. In the second hour of our program, Jeffrey Feldman will be with us. He's with Frameshop. He's the editor-in-chief at frameshopisopen.com and one of the real geniuses of our day on how frames are used and how issues are framed, particularly by the right wing. And our quote for the day from Thomas Jefferson: the spirit of resistance to government is so valuable on certain occasions that I wish it always to be kept alive. Indeed. We have with us, and we will be getting to all those things after our next break, but right now we have with us Randy Hall. He's a staff writer at CNS News, Cybercast News Service, cnsnews.com, the website. And, Randy, you're concerned about the growth of organized labor in the public sector.
Good morning, Tom.
Hey, Randy.
Concerned about the growth of it?
I'm reading the first paragraph of this news release. The growth of organized labor in the public sector is putting governments under the thumb of unions.
That's one way of putting it, yes. The story that I dealt with was called Public Sector Unions Feed Vicious Cycle, Analyst Says.
Right.
And it talks about the fact that, that in particularly in Oregon, where the Evergreen Freedom Foundation, which is where Michael Wright, who's the director and legal analyst for that, put out a study and did some looking into some things on that. And he's concerned about the concept of, workers in the public government sector, having kind of divided loyalties, as it were, between the unions and the government itself. And that's his main point in dealing with that.
Well, the government itself is the employer. The unions don't tell the government how to operate government. They simply tell they negotiate with the government on how to pay its employees, how to compensate its employees. What do you have against democracy in the workplace?
What do I have against democracy in the workplace?
A union is a democratic institution. A business is not a democratic institution. It's a top-down hierarchical reinvention of a kingdom, essentially. So the only democracy in the workplace that we have in the United States are unions. What do you have against against democracy in the workplace?
Well, what Wright says about that is that he says that it causes a vicious cycle. And in the talking with him about that, he said that basically that unionized government workers are expected to serve the public interest first over any other goal. But because they have to pay mandatory union dues, which are then rerouted into the campaigns of other political candidates, who are supportive of the union, then what happens then if that candidate wins, then the union goes to them and what he referred to it as seeking favors from those officials through like labor related legislation or hiring of new employees. As a result of that, he considers that a vicious cycle that leaves unions with even more dues paying members to further increase their political power.
So you think the executives of General Electric, which is not a democratic institution, it's a kingdom, it's a corporation, should be allowed to give money to politicians and seek favors from them and lobby them, but that the employees of government agencies who have a union should not be allowed to engage in politics? Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's, again, that's what Reich's...
Well, I'm curious what you're saying, Randy Hall. You're
our
guest right now.
Oh, okay. Well,
what's your take on this?
My take on this, and like I say, is that I think that Reich's has a certain point, and I think that there's something to be said for where the loyalties lie in something like that. It's made things difficult in Oregon, particularly when they used to.
Well, I live in Oregon, and I can tell you the public sector employees right now are the ones who are really, really upset because the governor cut back on the retirement fund. It's called PERS, Public Employment Retirement System, and he cut back on it because there was a budget crunch, and they're furious. And yet he just won renomination for his party's primary. So I can tell you, the public employees don't have that much power in this state.
Apparently not, but that's a sign, to be honest, of the problems that unions are having nationwide. Last year, during the 50th anniversary of the AFL-CIO, I covered a number of events during that time in which there was a major split. And one of the things in covering that I learned is that the unions, in which, you know, union membership amongst workers used to range, you know, somewhere close to 50%. Now it's down to about 12%. And as a result, that does certainly diminish the impact.
Right. We've seen a steady loss of union membership ever since Ronald Reagan declared war on working people in the United States in 1981.
Oh, it
started
off
by breaking up PATCO.
It's been going on a lot longer than that. It started in the 50s.
It started in 47 when the Republicans took the House and Senate and over Harry Truman's veto pushed through the Taft-Hartley Act. But we saw, nonetheless, at that point, unionization in the United States was 35% in 1947. And it was relatively level at that level until the late 70s, early 80s when it started to decline. And it has declined precipitously since Reagan, specifically because Reagan made the Labor Department hostile to labor. It's supposed to be looking out for the interests of labor. It's clearly not, hasn't since then. And because they changed the rules of the game in so many different ways. But if it sounds like you're saying two different things here, Randy. You're Randy Hall with CNSNews.com. You're saying on the one hand, the unions, it's a terrible thing, the power that they have to influence government, particularly when they happen to be government employees. And on the other hand, you're saying they don't have much power.
Well, in that article, I was talking with them and with the person who was in the study. The trick of it is where the allegiance, you know, of the workers goes to, and if it's,
well, it has to be to their employer, and you know, I don't think anybody is suggesting that government employees are not doing their job well because of their union.
Well, it's not that they're not doing their jobs well. It's what they can do to, you know, if you're going to accomplish something, you know, for themselves in that regard, that's one thing. But it's another thing when that goes over the needs of the people that
right.
they represent.
You also suggest in this public sector unions feed vicious cycle analysts say article over at CNSNews.com. Mm-hmm. That, quoting the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, a right-wing anti-union group, quote, union officials ordered a number of workers fired for standing on principle and refusing to pay forced union dues after union officials had violated the due process rights. Isn't paying dues to a union, which is democracy in the workplace, it is representing you in the workplace, you're a member of that union, isn't paying dues to a union essentially the same thing as paying taxes in the United States? You live here in this country, you're getting the benefits of the government in this country, you have to pay your fair share of it, and somebody who wants to try and freeload on the union is the same thing as somebody who's trying to freeload on their taxes?
Well, the unions are more or less an organization, and it's sort of like paying...
So is government.
The union... A union's not a government. It's not a government
organization. A union is a form of government. It is self-governance. It is a bunch of people collectively getting together and forming a democratic institution that actually holds votes. It's not like a corporation where you have a small elite that owns it and another small elite that runs it.
Well, as far as that's the same thing as any kind of a club. I mean, it's like membership dues into a club if you're going to pay...
Right. Right. Well, yes and no, except that, you know, a club has a social agenda. A union has the agenda specifically of representing the interests of the workers, which is a commons. That's the same as government. A union is a democracy in the workplace.
Well, it's one attempt at that, yes. And
So what's wrong with a union enforcing the requirement that you pay dues to be a member of the union?
Well, the problem of it is the folks that don't want to be in the union are kind of forced to pay dues whether or not they want to be.
But they're getting the benefits of being in the union. I mean, I don't like paying taxes, but does that mean I shouldn't have to pay taxes?
That's sort of an issue that they're kind of working out, I'm afraid.
Okay, Randy Hall, staff writer at CNS News, cnsnews.com, the website. Randy, thanks for being with us today.
Okay.
Good talking with you. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The words seem so simple, so meaningless, so nondescript, of so little consequence. A memorandum issued just 2 weeks ago by the President of the United States, May 5th, 2006, and it's on page 27943 of the Federal Register. And it's titled Assignment of Function Relating to Granting of Authority for Issuance of Certain Directives. It just seemed like no big deal. But I want to provide you with the context for this. Last week, we learned from USA Today that the NSA had acquired phone records from three big phone companies, Verizon, AT&T, and Bell South. And that Quest had said, thanks, but no thanks, we're not giving them to you. People got all indignant. There's a lawsuit going on, hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars. You know, these companies are being sued for the Bush administration on the one hand, Bush and others in his administration acknowledging that this thing exists. On the other hand, Tony Snow and others saying, no, it doesn't exist. You know, essentially talking out of both sides of their mouth. They're not sure where this thing falls. And now the companies come out and say, no, we never provided those records. This just in the last 24 hours. We now have basically had all three companies say, nope, we didn't do it. How is this possible? Well, we go back to this memorandum of May 5th, 2006. George W. Bush wrote, Memorandum for the Director of National Intelligence, by virtue of the authority vested in me by the Constitution and laws of the United States, including Section 301 of Title III U.S. Code, I hereby assign to you the function of the president. The function of the president. He's assigning that to the Director of National Intelligence, the head of the NSA, under Section 13B3A of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 as amended. So he's giving to the Director of the National Intelligence Service, that's John Negroponte, he's giving him the power to act as if he was the president with regard to the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the government organization that regulates corporations. He says, in performing such function, you should consult the heads of departments and agencies as appropriate. You are authorized and directed to publish this memorandum in the Federal Register, signed by George W. Bush, the White House, Washington, May 5th, 2006. Now, what's this all about? What it's all about is that by providing John Negroponte with that authority, he is authorizing companies to violate SEC Rule 15 USC 78 M paragraph B paragraph 3 paragraph A, which is what's specifically mentioned in this document. He's saying you can act as the... Now, what is 15 U.S.C. 78, et cetera? That's the part of the SEC code that says a publicly traded company is in violation of the law if they conceal transactions and activities from the public. So essentially what Bush did on the 5th of May was he signed a document that gave John Negroponte the authority to waive the rules with regard to Verizon, Bell South, and AT&T so that they can legally lie to we the people about what they're doing and not be prosecuted for it under SEC laws. Do you get this? I mean, there's basically either the story in USA Today is wrong, and USA Today is saying, no, we stand by our story. This is solid. Or the telecommunications companies, these three phone companies, they're lying to it. They're inaccurate. They made a mistake somehow. You know, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. Or their statements were technically accurate. You know, like they said, well, on Thursday we didn't hand over any documents, but they did on Friday. And now we come to the fourth option. That 2 weeks ago, realizing that this story might break and that these companies would have to own up to this because SEC law requires a publicly traded company to operate with relative transparency, that George W. Bush created an executive order giving John Negroponte, Death Squad John, the head of our intelligence services, giving Death Squad John the authority to give to AT&T, Bell South, and Verizon the right or privilege of ignoring laws under the SEC, under the Securities and Exchange Commission laws, and thus allowing those companies to, on the public record, through their spokespeople, say to us, no, we never gave those documents to the government, knowing that it's a bald-faced lie, but to do so legally. In fact, possibly even to require them to do so legally. Thus, the companies get out from under the lawsuits. We never know what's going on. Bush gets to go on with his program of gathering information about who are the Democrats out there, who are his political enemies, who are the reporters, who are they talking to, who might be leaking information. And nobody ever knows. Dictator Bush, all hail, 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Listen to the radio, see it on the TV, headlines in the morning paper, the clock of history repeats. They say we gotta make a stand, shoot them till they drop. Lay a little freedom there, like it or not. If I told you once, must have told you twice. The last thing you're looking for is their advice. To plead your case and make nice, nice. But the last thing you're looking for is their advice.
And welcome, boy. Welcome back. Yeah, we don't need no stinking neocons here. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics. 1-800-511-MAX. The telephone number, 1-800-511-MACS. For all things Macintosh, all things iPod, all things computer, really. They can help you out. And welcome back to the program. Our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM. And if you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com and click the live chat link. Once again, the Federal Register, page 27941. On May 5th, just 2 weeks ago, the President of the United States, George W. Bush, authorized, gave the authority of the president. He said, I hereby assign to you the function of the president under Section 13B3A of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 as amended, 15 U.S.C. 78MB3A. And you go in and you dig through that, you know, look at 78MB3A, 13B3A, and you discover that that's the part of the Securities Exchange Act that says that companies have to be truthful with the people about how they're operating. They have to operate with transparency. And he says to the director of memorandum for the director of national intelligence, by virtue of the authority vested in me by the Constitution and laws of the United States, including Section 301 of Title III United States Code, I hereby assign to you the function of the president under Section 13B3A of the Securities Exchange Act. In performing such function, you shall consult the heads of departments and agencies as appropriate. In other words, he put the director of national security, Death Squad John Negroponte, put him in charge of the SEC. Actually, in charge of the SEC, because it's part of the executive branch, so the president has the ultimate function. And so basically he can change any laws he wants, any rules he wants. And he can tell corporations, hey, it's perfectly okay for you to lie. In fact, you have to lie, and you're not in violation of SEC law. And it's increasingly looking like that's just what happened. A bunch of things here on the table. Should we have unions in the United States? Should government employees be allowed to unionize? The conservatives think not. They're launching an attack on government unions. Should we have corporations lying to us about our phone bills? I think not. We have Bush saying he's going to give the power to Death Squad John to make sure that happens. Bill in Orlando, Florida. Hey, Bill, thanks for calling the program. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I'm a retired police officer. I was on the job for 18 years. I retired due to injury. And your guest made me call in. Let me tell you, without a union, we were screwed. I worked with a union, and I worked without one. Mm-hmm. When I first got on the job, we didn't have a union. First year I was on the job, I was on food stamps.
You mean literally because your pay wasn't enough?
Correct.
Yeah.
And I was not getting any overtime. Most cops I know live on overtime.
Yeah.
Well, the thing of it is, at the time, the chief and the lieutenants had the discretion as to who got overtime. Now, if you were friends with them, you got overtime.
Yeah.
If you weren't, well, tough break.
Yeah.
Well, you know, at that time, my wife was a registered nurse, so make up for it. She goes off to work. I worked a 4 to 12 shift. She worked a day shift. She finds out about it. I go in. The next day, I'm told I'm going to days. My wife has to quit her job because of child care issues. Mm-hmm. That was the power that they had.
Yeah.
And once we got a union, all that stopped. Overtime was assigned equitably. We got our vacations equitably. Before that, God forbid, you had a bumper sticker of a mayoral candidate that didn't win or a councilman that didn't win. You were severe. You were punished for it.
Sure.
Look at you. No one turns to a union unless there's a good reason for it.
Yeah.
I mean, when there's abuses.
Well, in fact, more than 80% of working Americans say that they would like to be a member of a union. And yet fewer than 9% in the private workforce, 13% overall, including government employees, are members of unions. There is a reason for that disparity, and that reason is 25 years of warfare waged in the courts, in the Department of Labor, and in the court of public opinion by conservatives, starting with Ronald Reagan declaring war against organized labor by breaking PATCO and this very, very publicized mafia-like hit on the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Association, or organization rather. And now, now Bush right now is going after the air traffic controllers again. He wants to take the starting pay of these guys who are keeping us alive when we fly in the skies from $36,000 a year entry level down to $17,000 a year.
Tom, any working person who says they're better off without a union is a fool.
Yeah.
I'll say that right now.
I agree with you, Bill. Bill, I got to move along. Thanks a lot for the call, and I appreciate that. And by the way, fairfaa.org, I'm pretty sure, is the website. It might be fairfaa.com. David, check that out while we're doing this, and we'll get back to you on that. Everett in Lexington, Kentucky. Hey, Everett, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Hey, I really want to tell you, I don't get a chance to listen to your show too much because it's during the day, but I'm traveling today, and I heard this thing about this executive order that you're saying that Bush put out. It really shows the flagrant conspiracy between these phone companies and this administration of how they are doing whatever the hell.
Well, it doesn't demonstrate it. What it demonstrates is that it's possible. The fact of the matter is that because of Bush's executive order, we'll never know.
No, I know, and that's scary. I mean, this guy is a traitor to America. These phone companies, other than Quest, I admire that their executives there, their CEOs, were saying no.
Yeah,
this is not right. You know?
Yeah, but you look back on it, their CEO said no because he was under indictment on other charges, of corruption charges, and so he didn't want to get into more legal trouble.
Yeah, but I just want to say thank you for what you're doing, man, because we need people like you on the airways to expose the fraud, the corruption, and maybe America will wake up when they see and hear enough. I mean, God, I hope so, man.
Well, I hope so, too. Everett, thank you for your kind words. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Noah in Seattle. Noah, you want to take me to task?
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Noah.
Hi. You recall what I was asking about the 20,000 people that Bush disappeared, supposedly?
I don't.
All right, well, it was one of your last callers yesterday. You guys were talking about the comparisons between Bush's administration and John Adams. And you mentioned that, you know, John Adams arrested 20 newspaper editors or something like that.
Publishers, starting with Benjamin Franklin Bach, the grandson of Ben Franklin.
And then he said, well, at least John Adams didn't disappear 20,000 people.
Right.
Now, what did that exactly mean?
When that caller first called, he said that he said, what democracy, what elected democracy had...
Yeah, I heard that. Argentina.
Right, yeah. Had a president who came in and then was followed by a woman president who was described as a liberal who was then overthrown by a military junta, which then disappeared 20,000 people. And so his point was that, in his opinion, America is moving in the direction of, or the cons are setting up the possibility of, a military takeover of our government, the end of our democracy, and then people are going to start disappearing. And that was his
point. Now, there's one thing I have to mention to you, especially considering you're a Christian, like, you must understand the implications that, you know, a false witness, like, you know, there's plenty of false witnesses, but then there's this one kind of false witness that, you know, worships the devil, basically, and at the same time proclaims that what they're doing is in the name of Jesus Christ. Now, there's this resort in Northern California, in Sonoma County. It's a 2,500-acre redwood grove. It's called the Bohemian Grove.
The Bohemian Grove, yeah.
And now, every year they do this ritual there. It's called the Cremation of Care. And they do a mock human sacrifice of a childlike Iphigenia to the ancient Babylonian god Molech, who is known as the Eater of Children.
Right.
In the Old Testament, it says that...
This first got outed in Parade magazine back in the 60s. I remember when it came out. And actually, a friend of mine's father is a member of the Bohemian Grove, and he has gone to these things. In fact, he said that one time Henry Kissinger was peeing on a tree and hit his foot. So, it's true. It's there. But these guys don't view it as like they're Satan worshippers. They view it as, hey, this is a cool ritual. We're part of an in crowd.
Yeah, Alex Jones, a radio talk show host in Texas, Austin, Texas, I think, he snuck in there in like 2000 and got video footage of the Cremation of Care.
Sure.
And a year or two later, the Bohemian Grove came out and said, yes, this is authentic footage, but, you know.
Yeah, they don't deny it.
Don't take it seriously. It's just.
Right, exactly. They're saying, oh, it's just like Skull and Bones. I mean, you know, which is, whose crypt is.
Not human sacrifice.
Yeah, whose crypt is covered with bones and skulls. Including Geronimo's, apparently.
Order of Death.
Yeah.
Come on, it's not the Skull and Bones. It's the Order of Death.
No, I'm suggesting to you that there are a lot of similarities between the two, frankly. And you could probably go back and say, you know, yeah, there was also another society that had a crossbones, two femur bones and a skull, or whatever that arm bone is, and a skull, and that was the SS, Hitler's SS. Strange stuff. We wander off into strange stuff. We'll be back with your calls right after this. 45 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, Neil Young there with his song, Let's Impeach the President. Welcome back to our program. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Bill in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Bill.
How you doing?
Good. What's up?
Well, I like what you said about democracy and the principles relative to when taxes are made. They help with both our roads, bridges, infrastructure. They're set by Congress or the state or the local. And the union dues are often set in the same democratic principle by the membership.
Not just often, always.
Oh, well, I know that.
Unions are entirely democratic institutions.
And they almost always, like 95%, stay to the issues of better wages and working conditions. But I was thinking one area that you might want to think about, and that is association dues with condominiums.
Right.
Some of the people on the highest end of our economic strata of the United States own two or three condominiums around the United States, and yet they don't bark about having to pay their condominium dues because it benefits them.
That's right, because those condominium dues, then the condominium association, which is a democracy, by the way, usually,
right,
actually maintains the value of the condominium. They're working in the interest of everybody who's a member of it. Even those people who don't want to pay the dues have to pay the dues because they're deriving benefit from it. Great analogy, Bill. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. John in Dallas, Texas. Hey, John.
Hey, Bill. I appreciate you, Tom. I appreciate you letting me come on your program. I'm a soon-to-be 65-year-old Yellow Dog Democrat from Tennessee, and in the past I've been a proud member of two unions, IBEW and CWA, and just wanted to give you how much more are we going to have to take from this guy? This is unbelievable about this presidential directive.
I'm guessing we're going to have to take about, let's see, what is it, May, June, July, August, September, October, November, about six more months.
God, I hope we can get the Democrats out in Tennessee and get guys like Harold Ford into the Senate. I think that's going to be a real opportunity in Tennessee to vote for someone that can make some change.
It'll happen, John, if you get involved with that. I mean, you said you were in Dallas. I assume you're driving a truck through Dallas and you live in Tennessee.
Right, I'm kind of in my second childhood.
So the thing to do is, you know, go to Harold Ford's website or go to his campaign office next time you're in Tennessee and say, you know, number one, here's $25 or $10 or $50 or whatever you can afford. Number two, how can I help out? I'll you know, and just take an afternoon and go door to door, pass out campaign literature, talk to people, you know, or whatever you can do to help, show up, participate. That's how we're going to take our government back. It's going to be folks like you and me doing it.
Well, I agree with that, and I've been active in politics in the past, and I've already sent Harold some money, so I hope things work out for the best there. I did want to make one comment. I've really enjoyed your program. I've had a chance to pick it up on Sirius out here on the road, and I just wondered where you developed your debate skills. I know you've really taken on these neocons with a lot of intelligence and history.
I developed it with my father. When I was a kid, when I was 13 years old, my dad got me involved in the Republican Party, which he is still a member of. And I went full tilt boogie, man. I went to a John Birch Society meeting. I worked on Barry Goldwater's campaign in 64. Within a year after that, a year and a half after that, by 65, 66, I had become totally anti-war, anti-conservative, and I was like, you know, 66, I was 15 years old. I'm living at home, and I've become a Democrat, and my dad dad's a Republican, and he's a brilliant debater. And for the next 2 years, I lived at home until I was 17. Next couple of years, just taking on my father, it was the best practice you could have imagined.
Well, I bet it was.
We still do it.
My wife's a Republican. We have some rather spirited discussions over the dinner table, so yeah. I understand how that works.
Yep, and
again,
it's important. Go ahead.
Again, I really appreciate your program. I just wish we had all three of the live hours here on Sirius. Sometimes when I'm driving at night, I can catch you on the replays. But,
yeah, well, let the folks at Sirius know. John, thanks a lot for your call. I appreciate it.
You bet.
I appreciate
Thank you.
Kind words. John in Arlington, Washington, from John to John. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was your last caller on Friday, and I was mentioning that I believe that this country is a lot farther down the road, on the fascist road, than a lot of people realize. And you
Are
kind
you the
of
guy with the Allende analogy?
No, that wasn't me. I'm the guy who stands on street corners with Bush's a fascist and Peace the Fascist signs and gets threatened by a bunch of rednecks who drive away.
So your point, John?
My point is that what you mentioned is, if it was that, it's not really that bad, and we can still take it back because you're on the air. And less than a week later, we have John Negroponte, who has organized death squads in a number of different countries in the past, in control of our business sector now, granted that by the President of the United States, and literally, if we are a flip of the switch away from you not being on the air, Tom.
Yeah, a flip of the switch away from fascism, in other words, John.
Thanks a lot.
I'm not going to argue with you on that. I'm very concerned about the direction this country is going. And I tell you, 3 years ago when I started this program, three years and 2 months ago, I never would have believed that we would be this far down the road, frankly. Yeah, I still think that it's recoverable. I still think that there's tremendous opportunity and hope in this country. I think that democracy is in our DNA. We've had 200 years of it. In Nazi Germany, they'd only had a decade of it. So I think there's some differences, but we've got to wake people up. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Jeffrey Feldman, the editor-in-chief at FrameShopIsOpen.com, on the line with us. Jeffrey, arguably one of the most brilliant observers of the giant frames, the psychological tools that are the neurolinguistic programming tools that are used by everybody ultimately all the time, but used so intentionally and competently by the right wing in the United States. Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
George W. Bush gave a speech over the last few days here about immigration and what he was going to do. He's going to send people to the border. He's going to send troops, the National Guard, to the border. And he has this plan for some new super-duper technology, as you refer to it over at Frame Shop is Open. What are the main frames that Bush was tossing out, and why was he tossing them out?
Well, there were two main ideas that came out in the speech. They were training and technology. I mean, what's coming from the right from at Bush, you know, it's really his base that's attacking him on the right, and they're saying that, look, we want someone to stop what they're calling this flow of illegal immigrants into the country, and so he had to respond to them in some way to give them a sense that he was working on it. And so he pulled out an old friend that he used when talking in response to the same criticisms about what was happening in Iraq, and that's the training frame, this idea that he was going to put on the southern border 6,000 National Guardsmen in place, and that would be a temporary stopgap measure while they trained more border security. This idea of training is a way of focusing people's attention on the future, and his attempt to take control of the time frame that's unfolding and forcing him into to respond to his critics. The other frame is the technology frame. I mean, Bush pulled out this pie-in-the-sky idea of using what he called biometric identity cards. And Bush oftentimes gets people to focus on high-tech solutions when he's in trouble. I remember during one State of the Union address, when he was in a lot of trouble, he talked about a trip to Mars. And in the last State of the Union, he talked about technological solutions to the energy crisis. So those are the two ideas, technology and training, that he tried to use to take control of the debate.
It's interesting. These are also ideas that go back to Reagan. I mean, Reagan's technology frame was Star Wars.
Exactly.
And it turned into a multi-trillion-dollar boondoggle that benefited Reagan's campaign contributors.
Absolutely. Think that these frames, by virtue of the fact that they are constructed by PR people, are not real. I mean, these are very real. These set in motion people's sentiments, their allegiances. Interestingly, they don't seem to have really worked for his Republican base. People have responded to his training frame by saying, look, the number of National Guardsmen you're going to send down, they're not really going to do the job. We need something more. And to the ID cards, that's been shut down pretty quickly as well.
Right. Interesting. And with regard to the technology, the let's produce a super gee-whiz untamperable ID card, my concerns about that are twofold. Number one, AMC Theaters is right now using a program where they simply, and this is something that any company in America can do, by the way, and many do, they can simply, after you are hired or after you fill out your employment application, they contact the Social Security Administration and say this person with this address and the Social Security number claims to be themselves and wants to work here. And the Social Security Administration will say, yeah, that's that person and they live there. Or they'll say, no, sorry, it's a phony number. And if it's a phony number, AMC fires people. You know, it takes a couple of days for them to go through the whole process. But they basically will not hire illegals. And any company in the United States could do that tomorrow morning. But if we say, okay, you can only hire somebody who's suspected of being illegal if they have one of these super-duper ID cards, isn't that going to create a may I see your papers, please mentality in the United States and one that is particularly targeted at people who look Hispanic?
Exactly. I mean, and beyond that, it's going to create this culture of counterfeit papers and a whole lot of suspicion. It's definitely going to create that environment. What's fascinating is the response that I picked up from the Latino community in this country is one where they listen to what Bush is saying and they responded with incredible fear and concern. There was an interview or discussion really between Maria Elena Salinas of Univision. She's a huge figure in Univision news broadcasting, and Lou Dobbs, in which she was asked, you know, what is the reaction from the Latino community? And they said, look, no matter what people are talking about, no matter what practical solutions, Latino families are concerned, even legal residents are concerned that this whole immigration debate is just an attack on them. And this discussion about these biometric cards and what it would lead to, it just exacerbated that.
Well, in the 70s, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, but it arguably it started in the 40s when Roosevelt was integrating the army and picked up speed in the 50s as Truman carried that on and then Eisenhower. And in fact, actually, Eisenhower was one of the major forces in bringing African Americans into some semblance of parity in the military services. And then that led to the Brown versus Board of Education laws, case in 1954, which happened today, by the way, on this day in history. And from that point, from the mid-50s, when the federal government said via the Supreme Court decision, you can't discriminate against people based on their being African American specifically, from that day until arguably the 80s or 90s, there was this massive backlash against blacks. And particularly in the 70s, when cities were burning, the KKK was on the rise and David Duke was a serious presidential contender and all this other kind of stuff. And now the Latino community is looking around going, are we going to be the next African Americans? Are we going to be the next object of organized racism in the United States as a consequence of this kind of rhetoric?
Exactly. And following Bush's speech, there were these interviews that were showing up on Fox News in which you had individuals saying, look, we're tired of the president dragging his heels. We're going to take this into our own hands. We're going to go down and, you know, grab our hunting rifles and we're going to start doing this. And those interviews were not coming out in great numbers before that speech. And it really does speak to, you know, to what, you know, Maria Elena was saying about this fear amongst Latino families.
Yeah, and this is how people were talking about African Americans during the time of the Cimbiolini's Liberation Army and whatnot. It was, you know, and during the Civil Rights Movement, for that matter, the same kind of thing. And Yeah, it's amazing. In fact, we have a clip that we've played of a talk show host saying that he's going to go down and, you know, for fun, take a rifle down to the Arizona border and shoot some illegals. And it's incredible. Anyhow, you have another frame right up at the top at frameshopisopen.com. We're talking with Jeffrey Feldman, the editor-in-chief at frameshopisopen.com. Frameshop, let's change the story. The U.S. political debate is stuck in mob at the gates, and the real story is rot at the top. What do you mean?
Well, this is building from our last discussion there about what Bush's speech led to. This is draws on a great article by Robert Reich, who used to be in the then Clinton's cabinet, about the lost art of Democratic narrative. And what I write about is the importance of Democrats really defining the big picture story inside of which all the discussions about various issues are unfolding.
Also known as a frame.
Also known as the frame. I mean, it's one way to think about it that's very concrete. And what I discuss in this piece is that when we're inside a particular story, it comes with a particular plot, and that leads us to decide what is right and wrong. And the story that we're in right now is this notion of mob at the gates. And it's really informing everything that we're thinking about, immigration, security, energy, health, everything. And we should be, what the real story is, this notion of rot at the top, there's corruption. Just to kind of give you one very quick example, the notion of wiretapping, this which is going to be discussed a lot this week. It's the idea that, you know, the Republicans have this notion that security is based on this idea that the terrorists are itching to get into the country and to destroy our cities and kill all of our citizens, and that they need to clamp down in that direction. What we should be talking about in this wiretapping issue is the fact that we've got leaders in our national security system who are willing to break the law and compromise the Constitution. And you get promoted in George Bush's administration if you are inside the inner group that breaks the law. Just one example of how we need to respond to this notion of mobs at the gates with the story of rot at the top in order to take back the conversation.
And rot at the top could be described in a variety of ways. Corruption, the culture of corruption. Isn't culture of corruption really a way of defining the rot at the top frame?
I think that's a great way to do it. I really think that it is. I mean, in specific terms, take another example, immigration. I mean, we just had a conversation about immigration. The president spent all of his energy focusing people on these hordes that were running across the border. It's a great example of how the Republicans are trying to dominate that debate by getting people to talk about fixing that particular danger that threatens America, when in fact we need to be talking about the employers. We need to be talking about the corporations and the companies that are drawing these employees, that are in fact ordering a certain number of underwage employees to come into the country, and we need to propose solutions that take care of that problem.
Right, very straightforward process. And and in fact, there's, you know, news stories this week and last about companies that are actually sending recruiters down to Mexico. I mean, and gathering people together and bringing them up here. It's really quite astonishing. Jeffrey Feldman, we're talking with. Frameshop is open, the website. And Jeffrey, unless my clock is wrong, yeah, here we are. Here we go. We've wrapped it up. Jeffrey, I really appreciate what you're doing there. It's just a marvelous job. Frameshopisopen.com. Jeffrey Feldman, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank, or otherwise said, fair and slightly unbalanced. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the True People's Radio. Victoria Jones with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom. Well, I have a little bit of information for you that I have to say I believe I'm the first person to get.
Okay.
It's always very exciting.
That's great.
It's not very much information because I was getting it from Tony Snow, so you wouldn't expect very much from him. But I was suddenly inspired to ask the question. You see, I asked yesterday whether Karl Rove has told President Bush that he intends to resign if he's indicted.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer had been that he wasn't going to talk about private conversations or about blah, 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 you
right.
know, went on and on. So today I asked him whether Karl Rove had spoken to him about the CIA leak case. And he said, no, he hadn't. So I said, has anyone in the administration spoken to you about the CIA leak case? And he said, yes, they had. So I said, who? And he said he wasn't going to tell me. He wasn't going to answer any questions about that. So I said, well, what about White House lawyers? He said, I've already answered. I'm not telling you. You know, and he said, good question.
Good try.
So we know that he's been spoken to by someone in the administration about the CIA leak case. And I don't think he intended to say that.
You're right. I suspect he went just a little bit. His talk show host instincts are still there.
Yes, they are.
For better or for worse.
Yes.
The worst side of it is yesterday, or was it yesterday or the day before, that he basically came out and lied to the press, where Bush acknowledged the existence of the NSA program, essentially saying that, you know, he had briefed members of Congress, and so they asked Tony Snow, well, didn't Bush acknowledge this? And he said, no, he didn't. You know, look at the context, blah, 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 blah. Turns out he was just, you know, blowing smoke.
Basically, that was yesterday, yes. Yeah. And he does seem to have done that. Yesterday was also the day where he broke down.
Did anybody hold him to account for yesterday's lie?
No, not really.
I
don't think people are terribly surprised. I mean, yeah, although people did have transcripts of various things that the president had said and things like that, but I think also people are cutting him quite a lot of slack as he's new.
Yeah. Yeah, and because he cried yesterday. I mean, that helps, too.
I think the crying helped, yeah.
Yeah. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service. I'm curious, this memorandum that the president gave to John Negroponte, Death Squad John, on the 5th of May, 2006,
yes,
which gives him the power to waive Security and Exchange Commission laws as if he was the president. The order, in fact, it says, by virtue and authority vested in me by the Constitution, blah, 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 I hereby assign to you the function of the president under Section 13B3A of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. In other words, he's given John Negroponte power to change the rules of the SEC with regard to whether or not a corporation has to tell the truth and be transparent in their interactions with the public and their stockholders.
I think this is fascinating.
And the core of this is that we have these three companies now, these three phone companies, who've come out and said, no, we didn't give documents to the NSA. But 2 weeks ago, Bush gave Negroponte the authority to give the privilege to these three companies to lie to us, to their stockholders, to the press, and to everybody else about this very issue.
Exactly. It is really quite extraordinary. Now, I was going to ask a question about this until I suddenly got inspired by the Karl Rove thing.
Did anybody ask Tony Snow about this today?
No, they didn't, and I'll ask about it. Well, there won't be a briefing tomorrow. I'll ask about it on Friday.
Yeah.
I think most people don't know about it yet and probably haven't figured it out, but it is extremely interesting, and I'm quite sure that there's probably another presidential memorandum saying that they can all lie about it when we ask about it.
Yes. Well, obviously, there's a presidential memorandum saying that the press secretary can lie about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
They've been doing that, spinning left, right, and upside down for years and years. Fair has
done. It's the only thing that makes sense. I simply don't understand, Tom, and maybe you do, how it takes a week to figure out that you either have or have not been handing over phone records.
Yeah. Well, this is why the thing that I find interesting about this is the timing, that May 5th, Bush gave Death Squad John the right to do this. But you know what he did down in Central America. And
it's just funny.
Yeah, it's, well, you know, what the heck.
I'm sorry.
That's quite all right. That's quite all right. Control yourself, Victoria.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so back on May 5th, Bush gives Negroponte this authority. Then the story breaks about a week later. So they had to know that the story was in the works. I mean, the USA Today isn't like the NSA. They don't keep secrets all that well.
That's my theory, exactly. I think they must have known it was going to break.
So it seems, and then they let it play out in the press for a week or so and let all the indignation boil, and then they allowed the companies to come out and lie about their participation in it to make them all look bad. I think that this is sort of the same thing as what happened with Jason Leopold. At least seven people in the administration told Jason Leopold last week that Rove said that he was going to be indicted last week and was going to resign. Leopold publishes that story. This guy's a former, you know, credible mainstream journalist, publishes that story over on truthout.org, and the next week it doesn't happen. I think he got set up.
I think he got set up too, and we know that that is Rove's hallmark. We know that he does that kind of thing. I think Rove is likely to be indicted, but I'm not giving dates.
Yeah, but I think Leopold got set up, and I think in this context that USA Today got set up.
How interesting.
I think that this whole thing, you know, let it play out for a week and then slam them, make them look bad so no journalist will ever dare out this administration again. Just my theory. Maybe I'm paranoid. Who knows?
I doubt that.
Okay, Victoria Jones, thanks so much for being
with us,
Victoria. Great talking with you. TalkRadioNews.com, their website. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 and a half minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our toll-free number across the United States, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. Drop into our live chat room at tomhartman.com. The Dow right now down 194 points. The NASDAQ down 26. The Standard & Poor's down 18. Interesting, the European stock markets overall have dropped about 7% in the last week. Are we seeing the beginning of a bursting bubble of sorts here? I suspect so. I mean, we've been talking about this for a long time, that, well, for the largely and loudly for the better part of a year, how the fundamentals are just broken, and they've been broken by the Bush administration. Running this country into debt and international trade policies that don't work, and don't work for many nations that drink that Kool-Aid, that read Tom Friedman and drink that Kool-Aid. Anyhow, Charles in Columbus, Indiana. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind today?
Hey, man, I just want to say, it's not that I dislike your program. I need your program. It's necessary to me, man. It's my lifeblood.
Well, thank you, and, geez, I'm speechless. Okay.
I think a lot of people feel the same way, and I would like to get that number again that I could call up from Sirius and see if I couldn't go ahead and get you on for, you know, your full 3 hours.
Okay, Charles, I'll put you on hold, and you can talk to Dan at Air America there. Red in Sacramento, California. Hey, Red, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. What's up?
Good. Listen, I'm glad you had Jeffrey Feldman on to talk about reframing. And yesterday you had Belly Brooks on with the
yes.
West program.
Yeah.
Because I'd like to reframe the immigration issue in a way that I have never heard discussed before, and which I think really solves, not only solves short-term, but solves long-term, the problems that have been discussed. And I'll just give you the little vision. What I envision is a string of repatriation schools strung along our southern border. Very much on the order of community colleges, the big difference being is that they would be taught entirely in Spanish. That doesn't take care of apprehension or what I call first contact, which can be done through the workplace, people crossing the border, interceptions and stuff. But it solves all the other problems. By giving the undocumented person an option that instead of being detained and deported, they could elect to go from anywhere for 6 months, depending on, you know, their case evaluation, 6 months to up to 2 years, to a repatriation school to get the skill sets they need so that when they go home, they can deal with the despair that drove them north in the first place.
Well, Red, let me just interrupt you if I
yeah.
may. The population of Mexico... About half the population of Mexico lives on less than $2 a day.
I understand
right
that. I
that
understand.
Was also the case. That was also the case in 1950 when they were not streaming across the
country. I understand. So hear me out.
So, well,
here's
my assertion. Your premise is flawed. You're suggesting that the reason these people are coming across the border is either because of despair in Mexico or because of some force of nature.
It can be economic despair, family despair.
It's very simple. They're coming across the border because somebody's offering to hire them.
Yes, I understand that.
So if you stop people from hiring them, they will stop coming across the border, and you won't have to put a repatriation school there. They'll go back south across the border all by themselves.
Hear me out. That when we send people back, and the skill set to not only include vocational training to for their own region, not for here, but for whatever economy is there.
See, number one, the American people will never pay for it. Number two, you're talking about meddling in the internal affairs of another government.
It certainly costs a lot less than militarization or paramilitary solutions or law enforcement.
No, I agree. I think all of those solutions are crazy. The idea of rounding up 12 million people is insane. The idea of being able to seal off a border that's over 1,000 miles long is nuts. But if you stop the demand for cheap labor in this country by making it a crime to hire people who are not citizens of this country, then people who are not citizens of this country will stop coming here looking for employment.
I understand that, and I don't disagree at all. But what I'm saying is, imagine not only is a skill set can be vocational training and other skills, but it also could be political organizing and activism in their own country of origin community.
Red, if we want to change the political mindset of people in Mexico or people in Guatemala or people in Nicaragua, all we have to do is establish a Voice of America down there, or for that matter, build a website. Although a lot of poor people don't have access to the web down there, but I mean, there's a million ways to do that. It's a nice try. I tip my hat to you for thinking about the issue. I congratulate you for that. But the bottom line is that when you stop giving people a paycheck, they leave. Ask any community in America that has seen a major employer go, and then suddenly you see 15-20% of the community go. Look at Flint, Michigan. I mean, there are still some people left there because there's a social safety net that still has some little tatters to it. But by and large, when GM moved that factory to Mexico, a lot of people left Flint, Michigan. I lived in Michigan at the time and watched it happen. Michael Moore made a movie about it. What's his name? Roger and Me. And it's just very simple. You stop hiring people, they stop coming. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
Good morning. I remember the culture of Watergate very, very well. And it seems to me, the more as every day passes, this is deja vu to me. The stubbornness of this man, the secretiveness of the administration, the notion they are above the law. And then before even justice could prevail for God rest his soul, President Nixon. He was pardoned by Ford, pardoned a person who did it.
Right.
And I think that's forgotten.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't forgotten by voters. That's why Jerry Ford didn't get reelected.
Sure.
You know, that and the fact that he had never been elected president of the United States. I mean, people forget, I think, that Spiro Agnew had resigned because he was about to be impeached.
Good point.
And, he was about to be impeached because he was being indicted in whatever his state was, Delaware, New Jersey, Connecticut, wherever it was he came from on the East Coast, for bribery and corruption as what was he, the governor there before that?
Yes, he was.
Recall? Yeah.
Yes, he
so,
was.
So, good old Spiro T., with all his rants about the evil press and all that kind of stuff, he got bounced out on his butt. So, there is a precedent for both the president and the vice president being thrown out of office because they're both crooks. It happened before in the in another Republican administration.
Deja vu. I really
did.
And if anything, I'll let you go here, and thank you very much for taking my call. If anything, Tom, that I see personally, and I've brought this up before and you have too, I see a real flawed person about stubbornness.
In George W. Bush.
In George, that's what I see most of all of anything. I do not see, and he's not as, he's not this dumb person, president. Yeah. He's very.
No, and
very,
that stubbornness was marketed by the GOP to us as being resolute and firm, and really, you're absolutely right. What it is stubborn. He makes a mistake, he won't admit it, he won't change course. And, the old saying, if you always do what you always did, you'll always get what you always got. And Bush thinks that somehow he can change the laws of physics. Virginia in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Virginia, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. First of all, let me say I just think you're fabulous. I love everything you say, and I've been listening to your program for a long time.
Thank you.
And regarding the NSA and the phone records, I'm glad somebody finally pointed out and started talking about why all of a sudden are all these companies coming out and saying, oh, we didn't do that. And it was like a really delayed reaction, but I didn't have such a delayed reaction. I was really angry because one of my providers was in that list, and I switched to Quest because I have coverage. But they were very careful to tell me to read the service agreement when I got it. And when I received the service agreement, under the confidentiality and security section, I'm just going to read you a short bit of what it says.
This is the Quest service agreement?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. It says, Quest may access, and this is on their data services like email and text messaging. Mm-hmm. It said, Quest may access and disclose any such information as it deems necessary to comply with applicable laws and government orders or requests. That's not the whole statement, but I didn't want to get into all the detail. But
that's interesting. Or government requests.
Yes, applicable laws and government orders or requests. And then it goes on to say to provide, operate, and or maintain the data services and related systems.
Pardon my interrupting you, Virginia.
Yeah.
It says applicable laws and government requests. So it would mean that the request would have to be lawful. If it said or government requests, then they could respond to an unlawful request.
Yeah, what it says is with applicable laws and government orders.
Yeah, and that and there is very important legally.
Yeah.
That means
yeah.
that it has to be both lawful and a request or an order. And Quest's, you know, what Quest said publicly last week was that they didn't comply because they didn't feel that request was lawful.
Exactly. And I hope, you know, I'm glad I switched. I hope that they stick to that. But I guess, you know, I'm one of these people who buys these things and I don't really read all the fine print. And
nobody does.
If one thing this taught me is do that. But anyway, I just wanted to sort of vent my frustration with the fact that these companies I've been working with for a long time would do this to me as a consumer, and I hope I'm not the only one.
No, you're not. Virginia, there's widespread rage all across the United States. I can tell you the phone companies are hearing about it. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Nice to hear from you. I am getting emails from people who are sending me copies of the correspondence that they had with their phone companies, and it's not a pretty picture. The phone companies are, you know, dancing around. You know, how many angels are there on the head of a pin? How legalese can we get this? It's 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
There's a warm tonight and the moon turns the tide. When the stars take their ride, she'll be leaving. Where she goes, I don't know. She won't tell me what it is that makes her act like this. Should I ask, do you like to go walking on the shore, listen to the sea? Could it be someone kind? Could
it be? Hey, welcome back, my friends, to the vast, radical, liberal conspiracy. Take no imitations. Tom Hartman here with you 9.5 minutes before the hour. Yeah, this. The place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Just don't tell anybody, okay? 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom.
Hey. You know what? I just noticed there's something really revealing about your liberal callers and your listeners. Over the last few days, you've made it pretty clear and convincing that the silver bullet to solve this illegal immigration is to just punish the magnet, punish the employers, right?
Yeah.
But you got these liberal guys calling in, confused and diverted by all this, the con tactic of diversion and like the last guy, repatriation schools, and yet another guy last week say something else, and it's like, don't they get it? Just punish the employer, enforce the law. Why are liberals confused on this?
I think because there are cross currents inside the Democratic Party on this right now, Tom. There are labor unions who view illegal immigrants as as potential members of their union, or frankly, for that matter, there are labor unions who know that large chunks of their current unions are illegal workers, and they want to keep them as union members.
Mm-hmm.
And so they see, you know, the future growth of their union as being in bringing these folks in, particularly as the service unions, the unions that are based on a service economy rather than a manufacturing economy,
mm-hmm.
are growing in power and in numbers. They don't want that to stop.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got that on the one hand. And they're not able to see beyond their own noses. They don't get it. That,
right.
You know, if illegal aliens left, we've got 11, 12, 13 million unemployed people in the United States, and you got 12 million illegals in the United States. The illegals leave, and suddenly you don't have an unemployment problem anymore. And that's not counting the chronically unemployed. I mean, they're not counted in that 5.7 or 4.7% statistic.
Right? Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this isn't saying that you'd have to dip into the pool of the homeless even to hire people, you know, to put it in the most cynical of conservative frames.
Mm-hmm.
So, number one, they're not seeing that. Number two, you've got a lot of Democrats who are taking a lot of money from big corporations who are profiting tremendously from illegal aliens.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they don't want to rock the boat too badly, and that's why they're talking about a path to citizenship and all this stuff.
Yeah, but that's leaders. You're talking about the leaders. What about your listeners who...
Well, they're listening to the leaders. And you also have liberal talk show hosts and whatnot who want to be true to the Democratic Party or you know, whatever, who have interest in this area, who are saying, well, you know, let's do the Kennedy-McCain thing and, you know, create a path to citizenship, quack, quack, quack. And, you know, they want to get along and go along. And I think it's just a shame. I you know, frankly, it is not to pick on my peers specifically, but, I mean, just not, and it's not just talk show hosts for that matter. You find it on all the liberal websites. You find, you know, all these folks, the two frames that are predominant in the liberal world right now on the websites and on the radio are either number one, let's be compassionate,
right,
human
right.
beings too. And I agree. We should be compassionate. We should not punish caregivers, for example. But part of compassion is saying, hey, get your act together in your own home country.
Right. Right.
You know, you can call it tough love if you want, but it's compassion.
Yeah.
So number one, there's the compassion frame, which I think is being tragically misunderstood.
Right.
And number two is the you know, we need these workers frame, the you know, who's going to do this. And that's really just thinly disguised elitism. It's, you know, I want Jose to still mow my lawn. You know, I want Juan to clean my pool. I want my clothes, my food, my whatever, you know, fill in the blank to be cheap.
But they don't get it. They earn more money. That raises the floor and everybody earns more. But
exactly. Yeah, no, but they don't. You're right. They don't get it. They don't get it because the oddly enough, the people who are speaking the truth about this, by and large, are not within the liberal world. They're people like Ron Paul and Lou Dobbs. Lou Dobbs is a Republican, although he still is buying into the paranoia, the brown people phobia.
Yeah, he's even confused. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, he thinks it's got to start with the border, and I'm
but
like, you know, come on. Not only do you not want to secure, not only is there no need to secure the border, you don't want to secure the border because when you stop hiring people, you're going to have millions of people trying to cross that border going south, and you don't want to have a bunch of soldiers there stopping them.
Yeah. No, the focus, your frame is right. Stop the magnet. End of story. Stop the magnet.
Right.
Yeah.
Bottom line. Tom, thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. I appreciate
sure.
it. Matt in El Dorado, California. Hey, Matt.
Hi. Well, really quickly, I want to make it clear that there's a connection between AT&T, Verizon, and Bell South with the media. So the media latched right, you know, advertising dollars. And the media latched right onto the thing of, well, now they're denying it without any questioning by anyone. I've listened to all three networks.
Oh, yeah, because all the networks are taking money from the phone companies
exactly.
to advertise their products.
And so...
Surprise, surprise.
Clearly, the phone companies are lying, and I can't believe that there aren't going to be congressional hearings. Get them up there under oath. Get them for perjury because they're all going to lie. And it's going to be easy to prove because when I called Verizon, their representatives that answered the phone said, we've only turned over landlines and not cell phones. That's what they told me, and they've told other people that.
Well, now
so clearly, this is something that can go to court.
Yeah, now they're saying they didn't turn over anything.
But they said they weren't asked.
Hmm.
And so you see, they're clearly in trouble. If you ever had a decent country that would these guys aren't the government. You can take them to court.
Yeah. Well, there's a multi-billion-dollar lawsuit that was filed just in the last 24 hours.
I hope to God they pressure and keep going with the lawsuit.
Yeah. Well, I hope so, too, Matt, and I suspect that they will. That's probably why, you know, all this PR spinning is going on. amazing times we live in. Isn't it just a fascinating time to be alive, to watch all this stuff play itself out, to have an opportunity to be a part of it? It's really a sacred thing, you know, this extraordinary democracy and our potential role in it. It's why it's so important that we get involved and that we get active and that we participate in this democracy. It really and truly is a gift from, I would say, at the very least, from the founders of this country that we have to take seriously. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. We mentioned in the first hour of the program that George W. Bush, on the 5th of May, signed an executive order that gave Death Squad John Negroponte the authority to act as if he was the President of the United States with regard to the Securities and Exchange Commission, which, for all practical purposes, gave him the power to give the SEC the power to allow the phone companies to lie to us. Because this Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC rules, require that corporations operate in a transparent fashion. So Death Squad John had the authority to set aside that transparency. And now it turns out, as John Ponder points out over at Penn Cedar Review, this is not the first time this has happened. I did, by the way, mention this to you a few days ago. We're revisiting it, but I think given the context of the events today, it's worth revisiting. As Ponder wrote, President Bush's illegal domestic spying program is not the first government program for spying on American citizens. Okay. The first program for spying on American citizens actually started right after World War II. And then you had the Red Scares, and you had J. Edgar Hoover, and you had Ronald Reagan when he was president of the Screen Actors Guild, feeding names to Joe McCarthy and to Hoover about suspected communists inside his union. Back there, you know, most speculation is that the only reason he became president of the union was so that he could get access to information about who was a member of the union and who they were, so that he could feed that information to his right-wing buddies, Joe McCarthy and J. Edgar Hoover. And then that, you know, set the basis for Richard Nixon co-opting the FBI and the CIA to pry into the lives of Americans breaking into Ellsberg's office was just, you know, that wasn't even an FBI thing. I mean, that was off the shelf out of the White House. But the use of the FBI and the CIA and the IRS, for that matter, specifically by Nixon, to target his political enemies was the focus of one of the three articles of impeachment that were filed against him in the House of Representatives, or about to be filed. I believe they were filed and not voted on, because Nixon knew he was going to be impeached, and so he resigned instead, because he knew he had committed the crimes he was being charged with. So this is not the first time that the executive branch of our government has spied on the American people illegally. You could argue that it goes all the way back to possibly to Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman. Certainly into the Eisenhower-Nixon administration, and then the Nixon-Ford administration. But what's particularly interesting is that all this stuff came to light in the early 70s in the Watergate hearings. And as a consequence of those Watergate hearings, there was a big uproar about, you know, let's make this illegal. This is, you know, in part what led to the creation of the FISA courts and the Foreign Intelligence Security Act, I mean, the FISA Act. And Jerry Ford was president in 1976, as some of these investigations were going on, into what Nixon had done or what had happened during the Nixon administration. They pretty much couldn't investigate Nixon anymore because of Gerry Ford's pardon. But they, you know, they wanted to find out what had happened so that they could stop it, so that they could pass appropriate legislation. And the phone companies were concerned that they were going to be dragged before Congress to testify about this stuff. And two people in Gerry Ford's cabinet, or in Gerry Ford's administration, the two people basically at the top of Gerry Ford's administration, said to Gerry Ford, who was a nice, decent guy. I mean, you know, he was part of the Warren Commission. This was payoff for what he did in the Warren Commission, getting to be president of the United States. They knew that they could trust him. He was a go-along, get-along-and-go-along guy. He could keep secrets. He was a patriot. He was a person who believed he was doing the right thing for his country. And he was a good, loyal Republican. So they make him president. He was never elected president. He wasn't even elected vice president. He wasn't even the Speaker of the House. He wasn't in the order of presidential succession. But when Spiro Agnew left, Nixon, you know, looking around, who can I find who's, you know, not going to rock the boat, not too bright, not going to hassle, you know, Gerry Ford. So Nixon leaves, Gerry Ford becomes president. And Ford brings into the White House a couple of really powerful guys, a couple of real serious heavy hitters. And says, okay, you know, you guys advise me, what should I do here? AT&T does not want to be dragged before the House of Representatives or the Senate, before committees that have the power of the subpoena, and testify about their participation in snooping into the lives of private Americans who happen to be Democrats. That was their crime. They were Democrats. Richard Nixon went after them because they were Democrats. And the phone company doesn't want to be dragged in and have to talk about this. I mean, it's going to look really bad for them. Plus, it's going to look bad for the Republican Party. What do I do? And his chief of staff, Dick Cheney, and his secretary of defense, Don Rumsfeld, in 1976, told Gerry Ford, what you should do is extend executive privilege to the companies. See, there's this concept of executive privilege, that the president has a certain level of privacy that he can maintain, and he has to have that level of privacy so that people aren't, like, looking over his shoulder on everything he does, so that he can get counsel from people like Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney without it being a matter of public record, at least at the time. So just extend that executive privilege to AT&T, to the companies, to these telecommunications, the phone companies. AT&T was the biggest back then. This, of course, was before Jimmy Carter busted up AT&T. That came about 4 years later. And you wonder if maybe Carter going after this giant monopoly, AT&T, had something to do with this. I don't know. That's speculation. But what we do know is that Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld advised Gerry Ford to extend executive privilege to the phone company so that they wouldn't have to testify publicly. This according to the Project on Government Oversight. Gerry Ford did that, and that testimony never came out. Now, the guys on the right are going to argue that this is all about national security. We've got to keep people safe. My argument is that transparency in government is all about national security. Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, day before yesterday, ran a great montage. He had clips about, well, first of all, they're telling us it's only domestic, it's only international. If you're just making, you know, local phone calls, we don't want to know who you're talking to. We're not listening in, right?
This is not a program where we're listening to phone calls inside the United States. And it's limited to calls from outside the United States to calls within the United States, but not domestically.
And George W. Bush. And then the story comes out.
This is not about intercepting conversations between people in the United States.
So then it comes out, what about all those phone numbers?
Limited and targeted at international communications.
Oh, excuse me. We're still in the we're denying that this has anything to do with international. Okay, this is still the administration, folks in the administration saying it's just international.
This is not about intercepting conversations between people in the United States.
It's very limited and targeted at international communications.
What it is not is some sort of roving domestic spying program.
This is focused, it's targeted, it's very carefully done. You shouldn't worry.
That General Michael Hayden, the head of the NSA, preceded by Scotty McClellan, preceded by Hayden. So then it comes out. Then it comes out. And what happens? We start off with Chertoff.
You know, I'm not going to comment on the program just until...
Frist.
There's not been even a confirmation of the USA Today program itself.
I can't sit in here, confirm or deny the claims that are in the USA Today story.
Let me say that I'm not commenting on in any way any of the allegations made in the news story today.
Yeah, so first everybody's all eager to talk about it, and then they're saying, no comment. I don't have anything to say about that, don't know about that, don't know where it came from, don't know where it's going. And it just kind of sat there for a few days, and people got more and more outraged, and started filing suits. And then we look back, and hey, 2 weeks ago, Bush authorized Death Squad John to authorize the corporations to lie to us. And so now the corporations are coming out and saying, we didn't do anything. Nothing here. Nothing to pay attention to. Just move along. These are not the droids you're looking for. Yeah, we'll see how this one shakes out. 16 minutes past the hour, and I have a Fox News clip right after this I'll share with you.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Radio. You're in the democracy zone. Okay, previously, this from the Center for American Progress, Think Progress. Previously, members of the Bush administration and others have refused to comment on whether the USA Today story was accurate in reporting that the National Security Agency has been secretly collecting the phone call records of tens of millions of Americans. On Sunday, National Security Advisor Hayden said, "I can't sit in here confirm or deny the claims made in that story." But yesterday, both President Bush and Senate Intelligence Committee member Orrin Hatch, Republican from Utah, confirmed the program's existence, apparently by mistake. Bush was asked yesterday, why shouldn't ordinary people feel that their privacy is invaded by the NSA compiling a list of their telephone calls? And Bush replied, the program he's asking about is one that has been fully briefed to members of the United States Congress and both political parties. Okay, later on, Tony Snow denied that Bush said that, but that's what Bush said. Tony Snow, of course, formerly of Fox News. This is the Foxification of the White House here. Also in response to a question, quote, about recent reports of the government compiling lists of Americans' phone calls, quote, Orrin Hatch said that two FISA judges had been informed about the program, thereby acknowledging that the program exists. Although a Hatch aide later did a Tony Snow of Fox News, he said this should in no way be considered confirmation of any effort to collect phone calls. Right. And here, of course, courtesy of Jon Stewart and his fine crew over at the Daily Show on Comedy Central, a montage from Fox anchors and their thoughts on this. You hear this stuff, and the light bulb goes off about why people who watch Fox News live in an alternate universe.
Not domestic surveillance without court approval.
We're just talking about collecting phone numbers.
And just the numbers, not data about what was said.
Look, if you're not making phone calls to places like Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, then you're not going to be brought into this.
If we get hit again, and you find out that they're not doing that, aren't you a little ticked off?
If it's going to keep me safe, I don't care.
Yes, it is not great to necessarily hear they're collecting our phone records, but it's a heck of a lot better than collecting our remains.
Mm-hmm. Be afraid. Be very afraid. This is the core message of the Bushes. This is just a tragedy. And in the meantime, the Herald over in UK, theherald.co.uk, Ian Bruce, defense correspondent, the U.S. is updating contingency plans for a non-nuclear strike to cripple Iran's atomic weapons program if international diplomacy fails, Pentagon sources have confirmed. Strategists are understood to have presented two options for pinpoint strikes using B-2 bombers flying directly from bases in Missouri, Guam in the Pacific, and Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. Royal Air Force Fairford in Gloucester also has facilities for B-2s, but this has been ruled out because of the UK's opposition to military action against Tehran. The plan calls for a rolling 5-day bombing campaign against 400 key targets in Iran, including 24 nuclear-related sites, 14 military airfields and radar installations, and Revolutionary Guard headquarters. At least 75 targets in underground complexes would be attacked with waves of bunker buster bombs, which may have something to do with why they wanted to test this technology in Nevada in the coming weeks. Tomahawk cruise missiles, Iranian radar networks and air defense bases would be struck by submarine-launched Tomahawk cruise missiles and then kept out of action by carrier aircraft flying from warships in the Indian Gulf and Persian Ocean. The alternative to an all-out campaign is a demonstration strike against one or two high-profile targets, such as the Natanz uranium enrichment facility or the hexafluoride gas plant in Isfahan. UK sources say contingency plans have also been drawn up to cope with the inevitable backlash against the Basra garrison in neighboring Iraq. You think you're only going to have backlash in Basra? There are a few times when I am speechless, but I am right up there right now. I mean, this is really and truly tragic. And, you know, all that said, I think that it's probably a useful time for us just to very quickly review what's going on in Iraq just in the last 24 hours. Baqaba, a bombing and shooting attack killed 4 people and wounded 11 in the religiously mixed city of Baqaba, northeast of Baghdad. In Baghdad, 4 civilians were killed when 2 roadside bombs went off in quick succession. In central Baghdad, also Baghdad, 2 policemen were wounded when a roadside bomb went off close to their patrol near Al-Kindi Hospital. Also in eastern Baghdad, 2 policemen were wounded when a roadside bomb exploded near a police station. Also in Baghdad, 4 people were wounded when a roadside bomb went off in eastern Baghdad, police said. And political developments, the Iraqi parliament convened on Wednesday to resume the reading and discussing of, you know, a draft on their pulling this government together. Are they going to make the government work? Is it going to be a government? I tell you, if we attack Iran, it is not going to be a government. It's not going to work. It's going to be a disaster. In the meantime, the wonderful economy that the Bushes have brought us, the Dow falling through the floor, we'll see how that one plays out. We'll get, that and more right after this. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Neil Young there, keep on rocking in the free world. You know, there is a analogy here between George W. Bush and this administration and the old story of Nero fiddling while Rome burned, which, by the way, is still in dispute, but nonetheless, he was certainly incompetent. Whether he burned Rome intentionally or not, that's a whole other discussion. But this headline, the New York Times today, just popped up here by Reuters. The World Health Organization confirmed 6 more human cases of bird flu infections in Indonesia on Wednesday, including 5 members of a family whose case has triggered fears of human-to-human transmission. Sari Setiogi, the World Health Organization's Indonesian spokeswoman, said there are 6 confirmations, 1 from Surabaya and 5 from Medan. 1 from Medan is still alive. Blood samples have been sent to a WHO-affiliated laboratory in Hong Kong for confirmation. They go on to say an outbreak of H5N1 bird flu involving about 7 members of the family at Medan in North Sumatra province has worried health agencies around the world. But a ministry official said on Wednesday it was not a case of human-to-human transmission. He said there's no proof of human-to-human. The world is watching us, he adds. We are not being hasty. 4 of the 5 family members died. And they're concerned that this is a cluster. Well, we'll see. We'll have to see how it shakes out. But the bottom line is, what is the Bush administration doing about this? Some real and serious threats out there. Nothing. I mean, this 140-page report that they came out with a few weeks ago about what we'll do in the event of a bird flu epidemic or pandemic was essentially, we'll do the same thing we did with Hurricane Katrina. We'll leave it up to local officials, and when they break down, because local officials don't even show up for work because their families all have the flu, we'll blame them. I mean, that's what they said they were going to do. You read between the lines, it's right there. But they need another $65 billion right now to fight the war in Iraq, which isn't supposed to be a war because we've already declared victory, you'll recall. Don't you remember? The war is over. There is no more war.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
There you go. The war is over. What is going on now is an occupation, and people aren't real pleased about occupying forces. I mean, that's just the bottom line. Very simple. Very simple. So where is George Bush where is government when you need them? This comes back to this point that just cannot be made often enough. You can't govern if you don't believe in government. And conservatives fundamentally don't believe in government. They talk about small government, limited government, and what they mean is, to the extent possible, no government. Maybe a little bit of government to provide for a military, especially a military that we can partially privatize so that we can have Halliburton paying guys $150,000 a year to become the second largest army in Iraq. Over 20,000 private contractors over there doing security with machine guns and everything, and some of the fanciest equipment in the world. And you say, well, it's private companies. They can pay for the best equipment in the world. Yes, but whose dollars are they paying for it with? Yours and mine, our tax dollars. This is not just a scandal. This is a disaster, this entire administration. And it's up to us to do something about it, and it has to be political. That's the system that we have in this country. And that means not just saying, okay, in November I'm going to vote. That means getting involved right now. You don't have to run for office, but at the local level is the most important place to start. Because I'm telling you, every federal politician started out as a local politician, or the vast majority of them. That's the training camp. That's our B team. That's where these folks are coming from. And we need to be sending good people into the political process. Sean in Sacramento, California. Hey, Sean, thanks for calling the Tom Hartman program. What's up?
Hey, I just wanted to sort of chime in on, you know, the thing is that a lot of times that I'm getting into arguments with conservatives, people that, you know, quite often when you bring up oil and the issue of oil, you know, a lot of them buy into the arguments that are made by Fox News and the bought and paid for scientists of the oil companies. And a lot of them, you know, buy into the same kind of theorizing about global warming being false and it not being related to burning carbon fuels. And so it gets hard. You go round and round. But the one thing that I really can always argue and they cannot deny is the fact that we rely so much on foreign oils, we've essentially woven our own leash and then handed it over to foreign masters.
Right.
And you know, what I don't see enough of is, you know, the Democrats, and I think a lot of it is because they're all, you know, they're part of the political system which gets lots of revenue from the oil industry and the car industry. And what I don't hear is, you know, the real national security I don't think is going to be through our telephones or really over our borders, but it's the fact that our whole industry is reliant upon this foreign crude. And,
Democrats are talking about this, Sean. Democrats are talking about this. They're talking about it loudly.
I don't hear enough of it, though. I mean,
there's a reason why you don't hear it, Sean. There's a reason why you don't hear it. When you watch television, you will see ads for companies that are doing deep offshore drilling. You know, Mrs. What's-Her-Name, the lady who drills in the deep Atlantic. You've seen these ads?
Uh-huh.
You want to buy an offshore oil rig? I'm serious.
Yeah.
They only cost $800-900 million. Would you like to buy one? Because it looks like they want you to buy one. I mean, they're selling them to you. You want a ConocoPhillips, Exxon, all these different companies. You know, it's I guess they're trying to sell offshore oil rigs. No, they're not. What they're doing is they're saying to CNN and NBC and ABC and CBS and all the other, and all particularly the local stations that are carrying the ads, if you start talking bad, you start dissing us, you're going to lose 10% of your revenue because we're providing it.
Yeah. I mean, I just see it as the biggest threat. And, you know, these corporations don't understand how volatile the governments – well, I think they do get an idea how volatile the governments are that they're dealing with.
Oh, they know it well.
Oil. But
they know it well.
But, you know, it's the typical sort of business mindset. You just have to think positive and profits will happen. And, you know –
Well, no. It's you buy off the right people and profits happen.
Well, no. I mean, really, there is something about a businessman, and you see this in assertiveness training, that basically it's like George Bush being so resolute about whatever decision he makes. Is the idea is if you're just persistent, if you don't give up that sort of hope for success, you know, it's sort of Tony Robbins like 100-fold, you end up being successful.
Yeah.
The problem is that you start ignoring all the damage you're doing in the process of all the, you know, harm you've created. They become so focused, it's like, you know, only seeing your destination and not seeing the people you're hitting along the way or driving over.
No, I don't disagree with you at all. And I would encourage you to contact your local media, to contact your local TV and radio stations and say, you know, I would like to see some more coverage, and for that matter, the national networks, although it's a little harder to reach them. But if enough people contact their local media, the word will get to the networks and say, hey, on the network that you carry, I don't ever hear the fact that Howard Dean is calling for energy independence in the United States. I'd like to hear something about that. Why is the Democrats have a very clear agenda. They have laid this thing out. It's in print. It's been out forever. Why is it that we don't know about it? Why is nobody talking about this stuff? And by the way, I noticed that the big oil companies are advertising a lot on your station. Could that have something to do with it? And I think if enough people pass that message along, you might see some of these companies say, I guess our viewers and our listeners are starting to wise up. Mostly viewers. This is mostly television that this is limited to.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely I see it, and I just realize that, you know, it is my biggest fear one day that when, you know, we've outgrown our use, the rest of the world will just say, let's turn off the spigot and see them dry up.
And they may well be doing that right now. Look at $70 a barrel oil.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, the people, I mean, I was talking to my sister who's a Republican, and, you know, it is interesting to see how ignorant she is, because I'm just saying, well, what do you expect? They're all oil people. And she goes, what do you mean? I mean, she had no idea that the administration all had experience in the oil industry.
Not just experience. I mean, this is where they made all their money.
Exactly. And she, you know, she just found that out Thursday when I was talking to her.
Amazing.
And she's voted for him twice.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, how come oil's so expensive? And I had to go into this long talk about how it's all connected and this. And she just, I mean, you know, she couldn't wrap her mind around it.
Yeah. Well, that's the problem with so many Republicans. I see. I'll bet you that your sister's getting her news from Fox News.
I think she's getting it from her church, and you know, I think
same thing.
She's just happy that boys can't marry right now. So that's, you know,
yeah.
It's
as long as that, yeah, that's oh, geez. It's a tragedy. Sean, thanks for the call.
Okay.
Yeah, it's God, gays, and guns. I mean, they're going to be trotting it out. We had Paul Cameron on this program last week talking of it. Now next they're going to go after. I'm telling you. You know, before it was gay marriage, next it's going to be gay adoption. They're going to figure out some way to get gays on the ballot, right? And in those states where they've already trashed gay marriage, which is a whole bunch of them, I mean, it's what, 45 states in some way have limited gay marriage? And those states where they've already done that, now they're going to go after gay adoption, because what they've discovered is if they can put gay on the ballot, the Republicans will turn out in droves. And if they turn out to vote against the gays, then they will, while they're there, vote for a Republican. It's a sick and twisted system, my friends, a sick and twisted system, and we have to confront it and we have to out it. It's 45 minutes, no pun intended, 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
Welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Bonnie in Sacramento, California. Hey, Bonnie.
Hey, thanks so much, Tom. Sure. Grassroots. That's what this is all about. I've been writing you and calling. I was on hold for 2.5 hours last Friday and didn't get in.
Oh,
in California, along with Vermont and Illinois and several others, we've started the process of impeachment from the state at the state level.
You know, I've been following that. I've talked about it on the program a couple of times. My understanding is, though, that none of these states have voted on it. It has to actually be voted on by the legislature, signed by the governor, before it can go to Washington, D.C.
Right, and, but we are still working on it.
Do you think that's possible?
We're still working on it, and I mean, things are happening on a daily basis. I got an update yesterday that as they rewrite pieces of it.
So what's going on?
The latest one, I think it was just into the Rules Committee. It has 8 co-sponsors at this point. And let me open that sucker back up. Because it's got Jefferson's manual. It spells out everything. And
sure.
I need to, and there is a website that tells each state and community how to do it. The thing is, we've not stopped. And it can be done at the state level if we just keep making the phone calls.
Do you really think that Arnold Schwarzenegger will sign off on an impeachment petition?
Actually, I don't recall the governor being involved at all. From what I read, it's Secretary of State.
It has to come, what, just out of the legislature? Is that?
It's a joint resolution, H.A.R. 39 in California. And do I have the rules here? I'm in the message board. Any of them by Bonnie Sack will refer to it, but that it needed to get the majorities in both our House, our Senate and Assembly, goes to the Secretary of State.
Bonnie, nail down the details when we're not on the air, okay? And then, you know, call back and let me know. But, you know, the question that I have on this is how practical is this? Is if there's some practical possibility of this being successful, then I think people should throw a lot of time and effort into it. But what I've seen so far is that, you know, you've got on the one hand Republicans who are going to oppose it to the death, and you've got probably 3/4 of the Democrats who are scared to death of even the word impeachment. They're not going to pursue it. So, you know, shouldn't we be spending our time instead getting local candidates involved and elected and that kind of thing?
Well, we're not stopping that. But the thought is, now, as I see it, as we had at our great big impeachment forum here at the Democratic Party, the Progressive Caucus was the largest. We had standing room only of over 1,000 people. If everybody says, why aren't the Democrats doing anything in Congress? Well, they don't understand because they listen to other news that we don't have the majorities.
Right.
But if we can make enough noise at the state level, even if it doesn't go all the way, the news will get out there. They can't ignore anymore. Even our Democrats, our DLC Democrats, can't ignore that
want. I agree with you that we can walk and chew gum at the same time, and I appreciate your efforts, Bonnie, and you know I appreciate you getting out there and doing it. And if you have specific updates about things that are happening, give us a call and let us know. We'll put it on the air and we'll share it with our listeners. Arnie in Seattle, hey Arnie.
Hey, thanks, Tom. With respect to the warrantless searches, it's interesting that the head of Quest got the Martha Stewart treatment for resisting the NSA, and we don't know whether his successor relented or not. We do know that most of the members of the Intelligence Committee, the judicial committees, haven't been briefed as required by law. And we also don't know whether the information was supplied in real time, which could have some enormous consequences.
Now, hang on just a second here, Arnie. You're suggesting that the head of Quest, I don't have his name in front of me, but the CEO of Quest at the time that this request was submitted, was under indictment for insider trading, as I recall, that he had been selling stock or stock options based on...
He's been accused of it.
Yeah, he'd been accused of it, knowledge that the stock was going to fall, and which is, you know, what Martha Stewart was originally being investigated for. My understanding was that he was already under investigation. He was already being hassled, and therefore, when the feds came to him and said, would you do this, he said no because his lawyers said, hey, you already have enough legal troubles, don't create more for yourself. Are you suggesting that the feds came to him, said, do this, he said no, and therefore he got indicted?
I'm saying that the charges were certainly, he was leaned on a lot harder than he would have been. And as we've seen with these insider trading investigations, they're very strategic in who they pinpoint and who they let slide. But on a larger issue, I think the fact that we don't know whether the information was supplied in real time or not.
Right.
By the people who did comply. We also don't know whether the present head of Quest complied with the requests or not. In other words,
whether Quest has complied since then. All we know is that back when the initial request
exactly.
was made, that president, that CEO at that time said no.
And we do know that most of the members of the intelligence and judicial committees have not been briefed on this, as is required by law, which ipso facto makes it illegal.
Well, beyond that, I mean, it's illegal to begin with. How can you brief members of Congress on something that you're doing that's illegal? The NSA is supposed to be doing international work. They're supposed to be doing work offshore. The FBI does national work. The FBI has the authority to spy on Americans.
Well, Tom, just think about it. What happens if the information's being supplied in real time?
Yeah, it's downright spooky, Arnie. It's the bottom line. Thanks a lot for the call. You know, I hadn't considered the possibility that the CEO of Quest got busted because he said no to the feds. I had thought it was the other way around. Tomorrow, Alvin Toffler will be here with his new book, Revolutionary Wealth, how it'll be created and how it'll change our lives. And John Gideon with Voters Unite is going to drop by about the ultimate felony against democracy, the privatization of our vote. That and more, and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, Uncommon Sense from the Radical Middle. Take no imitations, and remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.